Well, the high cost of housing and the difficulty in finding work break out as key issues in a new Pace University poll conducted in cooperation with WNYC, CBS2, and the New York Observer. This was a random survey of 600 New Yorkers who consider themselves likely to vote in the Democratic mayoral primary this summer, so these are core Democrats. The poll has a 5 percentage point margin of error. Now listen to some of these numbers on housing. A whopping 82% think the city's housing boom has been bad for the city. A third say they are somewhat likely or very likely to leave New York City as a result of the increasing cost of housing, and asked an open-ended question about what item is the most financially burdensome to them. By far, more people mention housing than any other item. In the area of jobs, just 8% of respondents thought there are plenty of jobs in New York City today. More than two-thirds, 67%, said jobs are difficult to find. About a third of New Yorkers think they themselves are worse off economically today than they were 4 years ago when Mayor Bloomberg took office. Just 23% said they are better off. And yet, among these prime Democrats, the city is seen as doing pretty well overall. 46% said New York is generally headed in the right direction, while only 35% think it's off on the wrong track. And while this is primarily an issues poll, it does contain some very good horse race news for the mayor. He had higher favorables and higher strongly favorables than any of the Democratic challengers. And remember, this was a poll of prime Democrats, likely voters in the Democratic primary. Maybe he should have entered that race. Some other findings. Education was listed by 32% as the most important issue in the race, followed by housing at 18% and the economy at 10%. The survey found a certain resistance to the idea of a gay or lesbian mayor, in theory, more than with other identity groups. Oddly enough, perhaps, people living in rent-regulated housing registered the most anxiety about housing costs. These core Democrats are probably not much disappointed by New York failing to get the 2012 Olympics today, and they have little use for stadiums, any stadiums. Even the revised Olympic proposal with the new Shea Stadium that's gotten good press, even that is seen as a bad idea by a small majority in this survey. Jonathan Trichter is director of the Pace Poll and joins us now for a lot more. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And you know, I thought... it would be interesting for you first just to talk about the Pace poll, and especially since we're doing this in cooperation as kind of a partnership between two not-for-profit institutions. You know, why are we bothering to do polling, which is so maligned, so overdone, I think even you'd agree, and so misused in our political system? And for our part, we saw a lack of meaningful public opinion measurement on urban issues, particularly housing in this round. So talk about how you see the Pace University poll in general, which is still relatively new, let's say in relation to the commercial polling companies.
Okay, sure. Let me actually start with the specifics first, because I want to thank my media partners, especially WNYC, who participated actively in the crafting of the survey design and then helped in the analysis and focusing on some issues that we didn't anticipate would pop, so to speak. But generally speaking, the Pace University poll started out a couple of years ago with the mission to inform the public discourse in a way that would be helpful and then serve a civic duty to sort of, again, to educate and inform the public discussion of current affairs. And one of the reasons why we wanted to partner with WNYC and the New York Observer and WCBS 2 News on this particular poll is because we wanted to sort of launch a new brand of public opinion survey research that would be made available to the masses, that would focus on issues in a way that most polls don't. And one of the things that we did with this survey and that we will continue to do as we launch a series of surveys in conjunction with WNYC and our other media partners is to track the responses, the voters' responses to the unfolding campaign and also to the issue landscape as it changes and as it sort of shifts. This is not something that traditionally a lot of polling institutes do. They're oftentimes available just to sort of raise the profile of the university and get them in the news. But we and the president of our university, David Caputo, is a political scientist, and he wanted very much to actually be a part of the civic fabric of the city and its most important public events, such as elections. So that's a bit about our mission and why we sort of did this partnership with you, and we're very pleased with the outcome.
Good, and I'm excited about it, and some of the subsequent ones we'll do during the mayoral race, and again, how We can dig up information about public opinion that might really inform public policy. So let's dive into some of this. The high cost of housing and the difficulty of finding work, top two. And let's look at these pretty astounding housing results. 82% never agree on anything. What exactly did 82% say about the housing boom?
82% of prime Dems, we should remember here that by prime Dems we're talking about voters who are very, very likely, based on past behavior and their professed intent to vote, 82% of these prime Dems think that the real estate boom is actually bad for them. Over a third, just over a third, actually feel it threatens their living, their continued life in New York City. They feel that they may have to move out of the city due to housing costs. That's a real, perceived threat. We often talk about public affairs as something that the public is concerned about. But when you're talking about an issue like housing, which affects them so personally, you've got to think you've grabbed their attention. And this is also something that we should just, when we talk about this in the context of this survey, I was reminded by one of our media partners, reporters Ben Smith of the New York Observer, that in the context of a mayoral race, this affords a candidate an opportunity that may have yet to be exploited. Because if you judge by the campaign materials of the Democratic candidates to date, they believe that education is the hot-button issue.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately for them, almost a third of prime Dems think that the public schools are better today than they were 4 years ago, while only 19% think the schools have deteriorated. And it's tough for a challenger to defeat an incumbent by promising to do just a little bit better. That's not traditionally a rally cry that calls people to the barricades. But a Democrat would be well advised to advocate a program to build affordable housing.
And we'll get to the education numbers later, which I think come out pretty well for the mayor and his reform program. A net positive over negatives in terms of how people perceive the change in the public schools. And maybe it's just more difficult to come up with a housing policy than it is to come up with some, catchy sounding proposals on education like lowering class size or stopping social promotion. I want to read to our listeners the way you asked the question on whether housing has been good for New York. This is how people who were called up in the Pace poll were asked it. The caller said, "I would like to read you two statements about housing prices in New York City, and afterwards I would like you to tell me which one you agreed with more. Statement A, some people say that rising housing prices are good for New York City because they encourage people to build new housing and because they increase home and apartment values for current residents. Other people say that rising housing prices are bad for New York City because they make it harder for people to buy a home and because they make it more expensive to live in New York City. Which statement do you agree with more?" And 82% said bad for the city. So it wasn't so much bad for me as an individual. It was their judgment of what's good for the city overall.
Yeah, this is something that seeps into their consciousness and that affects city living for so many New Yorkers, so many prime Dems. And to me, one of the deep disconnects, again, in the context of the mayoral campaign, is that between our civic discussion and our civic policies, right? Universally, policymakers agree that New York needs more housing. And at the same time, our government seems to subsidize so much other development. There are funds available to help build two new baseball stadiums, a new football stadium, an expanded convention center, two new museums, and acres of empty office space. It's as if a drowning man is demanding every conceivable form of assistance other than being pulled from the water. And that's to answer your question, which was, why is this not a candidate's platform? Why don't we hear this from the candidates? And it may be because it's tough to put that in a catchy phrase, but my real answer is an honest, I don't know.
And we will ask the candidates in their next go-around. I'll tell you one funny thing along those lines. The last time I interviewed Virginia Fields, I asked her about her housing proposal, and she's actually proposing fewer new units of affordable housing subsidized by the government than Mayor Bloomberg is. The difference is that hers would be more concentrated in the lowest income categories, but actually fewer units. So that's maybe one example of failing to seize the opportunity. Oddly, though, among the housing respondents, this anxiety was most pronounced among people in rent-controlled or rent-stabilized apartments, you found. How do you explain that?
Well, it's tough to explain initially at first blush because, of course, rent control was a policy that was enacted after World War II to alleviate housing concerns and concerns about housing crises. However, we know that in New York City and New York State politics, rent control has come under attack, and reforms at the state level have chipped away at rent control regulations. And so what we may be seeing in response to that question are the anxieties of people who are in rent-controlled and stabilized apartments now, who are no longer confident that they will remain so throughout their life in the city.
And you found that a third of New Yorkers, 34%, and tell me if you think this is as startling a figure as I find it to be on first blush, a third said they were either very likely or somewhat likely to move out of the city because of housing prices. That's a lot of churning if it really happens.
Yeah, it's a tremendous amount of turnover. And one of the things that I think makes New York City special and makes any community special is stability. I mean, you need stability to build social capital, which is something that breeds interconnectedness, trust, reciprocity, and it leads to, in real terms, measurable terms, general happiness, better schools, child welfare, and more stable, nourishing communities.
Although, on the other hand, to be fair, a lot of the growth in New York City in recent years is because of the churning in terms of a lot of immigrants coming from everywhere, incredible immigration boom in the 90s and the 2000s. And that's one of the things pushing up housing prices, but it also means that a lot of relatively poor people from all over the world are dying to come to New York.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Of course, we have in our interviewed group a fewer number of those new immigrants than are in the city at large. Mm-hmm. But we should point out that we actually conducted an oversample among new registrants, or those who registered to vote after the 2001 primary and voted in some municipal primary after the 2001 primary. Which means that we do know a bit more about them than a lot of other polls. So we've got a sort of a trough of data among the newest voters to the process that we plan to look at over the course of this study and even afterwards to figure out how the new immigrants are going to shape the electorate and also shape shape the what our leaders in the future of New York City, what they actually look like.
Jonathan Trichter, director of the PACE poll, my guest on WNYC. And take us another level into that, because I was very interested by this. One of the things you set out to do here and that you intend to do over the course of the mayoral race and subsequent polls was track how the city is changing by comparing those newly registered voters with those who have voted before in New York City. Did you find enough new registrants to get any meaningful breakout results?
We did. I mean, we did. And you can also, of course, see shifting political landscapes in the city if you just look election to election. If you go back just 30 years to 73, for instance, when Abe Beame ran against Herman Badillo in a runoff, you might remember that Herman Badillo received 9 out of 10 votes among Puerto Rican New Yorkers and 7 out of 10 African-American votes among New Yorkers who voted in that primary. It's no longer the case that the Puerto Rican candidate in this Democratic primary is receiving such a high percentage of the vote from New Yorkers of color who are participating in this primary. Freddie Ferrer is running and he's a Latino, and he's got about half of the Latinos that are supporting him, or I should say a good third of Latinos, and a little bit more of the new registrants who are Latinos are still undecided, which is much less shows much less racial solidarity than in elections past. We also conducted an experiment, which you alluded to at the beginning of the show, or beginning of my participation in the show, where we tried to test the theory, which has long been axiomatic in New York City political circles, that municipal elections are all about race and ethnicity. And to do that, we asked voters to rate a hypothetical candidate's various attributes on a scale from 1 to 10, where 10 was an attribute that was very appealing to voters.
So hold that for a minute as we take a break, and we'll come back and look at what hypothetical attributes people would want in a New York City mayor. We also have a little WNYC PACE poll contest here, and we will give one of you a Brian Larochelle t-shirt if you are culturally aware. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And another reminder that tomorrow morning at 11, we'll have the first Brian Lehrer Show Commentary Slam, and you are invited to opine. This is kind of like a poetry slam, except it's for your editorial opinions. Now, here's how it'll work. We know you have these opinions. We want you to write a commentary of up to 90 seconds in length. We actually want you to take the time to write a piece. Write an editorial or an op-ed or a commentary, call it whatever you like, on the issue of your choice. It must time out at 90 seconds or less. We will judge your pieces on original thinking, good writing, and the persuasiveness of your argument, and the best three in the hour will win our highly coveted Brian Lehrer Show t-shirts. So take the time. We encourage people from diverse political points of view to participate. Write a commentary on any issue of up to 90 seconds. We'll judge it on original thinking, good writing, and the persuasiveness of your argument, and we'll take your commentaries for the first Brian Lehrer Show Commentary Slam tomorrow morning for the full 11 o'clock hour. We continue now with Jonathan Trichter, director of the Pace University Poll, the first one that they conducted in cooperation with WNYC, as well as CBS2 and the New York Observer, is just out on issues in the mayoral race. This was a poll of likely Democratic primary voters for now, since that's the first election coming up. And Jonathan, before we continue, I have to give you credit for two cultural references in the analysis of your results. And let's see if any of our listeners has the cultural literacy to match you. At one point in this release, you ask, who are the prime Democrats most likely to be the next Wally Pipp? And at another point, you say, by focusing on education rather than, say, housing, Democratic candidates may be duplicating the folly of Lord Cardigan's attacks on an entrenched enemy. So here's the challenge, folks. We will give a Brian Lehrer Show t-shirt to the first person who can call up and identify both Wally Pipp and Lord Cardigan at 212-433-WNYC. Now, this is tough because they're from very different streams of history, to say the least. But if you're the listener who can identify both Wally Pipp and Lord Cardigan, as Jonathan Trichter did in the Pace poll, call us up. We'll put you on the air. And if you get it right, you win a much coveted, not available in stores because who would buy them, Brian Lehrer Show t-shirt, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And, oh, look at those phones go. Well, we have a culturally literate crowd out there. We'll see if anyone can do it. Now, while we're getting ready to take one of those calls, Jonathan, you started to talk about this testing you were doing of hypothetical attributes of a mayor somebody would like to see in New York.
Yeah, so let's cut right to the chase. I mean, it turns out that among prime Dems, the ideal candidate for mayor is an African-American male with a graduate degree. He can be Catholic, Jewish, or Protestant, but he better not be too religious, and he definitely cannot be gay. He also better include graduate school in his future because voters much prefer candidates with advanced degrees.
Now, African-American male, first of all, that's a big one. In theory, most of these Democratic primary voters would like to vote for an African-American. I mean, that probably represents demographic change in who these core Democratic voters are over the years.
Mm-hmm. And as new registrants reshape the electorate, again, remember we did an oversample. We interviewed more new registrants than actually exist proportionately in the electorate to find out where the city was moving in terms of the leaders it elects. As new registrants begin to take up more of the share of the vote in Democratic primaries, female candidates should gain strength because new registrants express a far stronger preference for female candidates than prime Democrats do generally. But male candidates still hold a slight advantage over female candidates. And Asians, it turns out, suffer the greatest racial or ethnic disadvantages at this point.
And what was that about gay and lesbian candidates?
The Democratic primary is not electorate is not ready for an openly gay or lesbian candidate to run for mayor. Among the attributes we listed, on a scale from 1 to 10, only 2 drop below the 5 barrier, which would represent, you know, an attribute that somebody would view as neutrally. And one of those was a gay or lesbian candidate. The other one was a religious candidate. So really, running in the Democratic primary, you can't be from either end of the cultural wars.
At least in theory. Okay, do we have somebody ready to go who thinks that nobody yet who thinks they know the answer? Okay.
Let me also, though, take a moment to share the credit for the cultural references with my co-author, the assistant director of the Pace poll, Christopher Page, who's sitting outside. Chris has an expanded role in our operations and is due much of the credit for the written analysis, which, by the way, will be online this evening. You can get it at the Pace website, www.pace.edu.
It's not up yet. I can only assume, too, that we'll put the whole thing up with all the questions and everything and all the analysis at WNYC.org. Now we've got one of these people, the first person to actually tell our screener. I'm not sure our screener knows the answer, but to tell our screener that he does know the answer, let's see if he really does. Phil in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, how are you? I think I know the answers. Which do you want me to start with first?
Take your pick.
Well, Wally Pipp was the first baseman, I think, was the position. And one day, he had a headache, and he told the team manager, the Yankees, he didn't want to go play that day. So a less visible player, Lou Gehrig, was put in, and of course he turned out to be the Iron Horse?
Yeah, he played the next, I think, 2,156 games in a row.
And so Pip, you know, was eventually traded away. I think it was to Cincinnati, but he lost his gig as the first baseman, and had he not told the coach, you know, oh, I have a headache today, you know, he presumably would have been kept in the game.
All right, so you know your Yankees trivia. How about Lord Cardigan?
Well, Lord Cardigan was a very autocratic military leader, and he was the military leader who led the charge of the Light Brigade, which of course was a military disaster in the Crimean War, the British War in Crimea.
Excellent. I would say, Jonathan, and I presume you'll concur, that Phil in Manhattan has won himself a Brian Lehrshaw T-shirt.
Yeah, congratulations. I'm very impressed.
I'll wear it proudly because I think this is a great show.
Thank you. And there are not many people who know, you know, that level of Crimean War trivia and 1920s New York Yankees trivia. So
sometimes my friends, you know, play Trivial Pursuits with me,
yes,
you know, as couples, and I play against them as a single man, and I often hold my own, you know, even against two people on the other teams.
Change your skin color and you can run for mayor. Hang on, Phil. Don't go away. We're going to take your address off the air so he could send you to the shirt. Thanks a lot.
Let me just add parenthetically that Lord Cardigan was also responsible for the Cardigan sweater. So not only was he responsible for the death of hundreds of thousands of Europeans in the Crimean War and later in World War I, but he was responsible for a significant fashion faux pas, both of which mark low points in Western civilization.
I'm not sure which is worse. So let's talk about the statements behind that little bit of playfulness. You asked, who are the prime Democrats most likely to be the next Wally Pipp? That is to say, they have a headache and sit out the primary election. Why did you ask the question?
We wanted to find out who was participating in the Democratic primary on an active level. And one of the things we found out is that Democratic primary voters were more in tune with news coverage than regular old registered voters, right? And one of the ways this electorate differs from the rest of the city and its voters is that more than three-fourths, 78% of prime Dems are following news about the election. That stands in contrast to the percentage of plain old registered voters in New York. In a Times poll recently, only 56% of regular voters claim to be paying a lot or some attention to this year's campaigning.
Now, that's still not bad, right?
No,
it's not. There's a little more interest in the race than I might have guessed.
Me too. And we have to remember, though, that one expects people likely to vote in a municipal primary are also likely to follow news about that election for much the same reason, not to mix metaphors, that people with season tickets read the sports page every day, I would think. But following the news is about all they're doing, and this is where Wally Pipp sort of comes into the picture as a reference. Only 16% of prime Dems are trying to persuade others to vote for their preferred candidate. Just 15% are donating money to political causes in connection with this race, and only 12% are attending political events. Also, only 8% are displaying any sort of campaign paraphernalia. And those numbers might improve in future elections because more than a quarter of the Democratic primary electorate expects to become more active in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take those data together, then it looks like some loyal Democrats may be sitting this election out at this minute.
And this is, I guess, where you get into how well Mayor Bloomberg polls among even these core Democratic primary voters, right?
Yeah, he has the highest favorability ratings of all the major candidates for mayor among yellow dog Democrats, right? I mean, these are
But you say yellow dog Democrats, that's another little cultural literacy reference.
Mm.
Remind us who the yellow dog Democrats were?
Traditionally, the thought of is Southern, but really the term applies to any Democrat who would vote against a qualified Republican even if the only other candidate on the ballot were a yellow dog. So that for Bloomberg to be popular among those hardcore Dems, I mean, it's a political feat. It's akin to selling Budweiser to Germans. It's like selling pork futures to people who are, you know, more used to buying Israeli bonds. I mean, these are not the people who would normally embrace a Republican mayor. And the ironic question is whether or not Bloomberg could win the Democratic primary. It's especially ironic because as mayor, he couldn't write nonpartisan elections into the city's charter. He failed at that. But as a candidate, he seems to have written it into the hearts of voters. His popularity among these hardcore Dems suggests that they view him in a very nonpartisan light.
And at this point, I want to open up the phones for any questions that any of our listeners may have about any of the PACE poll in cooperation with WNYC. Findings. We've been talking about housing. We'll talk a little bit more about jobs and education, some ground zero questions. You can do a horse race question or two if you want. Some interesting findings on Latinos and Freddie Ferrer. Talk about how polls are done if you want. I'm going to do a little polling 101 with you, Jonathan, as we go. And our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And it was an astounding figure that, tell me if I remember this correctly, that 62% of these, again, core Democratic primary voters, saw Mayor Bloomberg as generally favorable or strongly favorable.
That's correct. And that's compared to 59% for former Bronx Borough President Freddie Ferrer, 51% for current Manhattan Borough President Virginia Fields, 35% for the City Council Speaker Gifford Miller, and 29% for Congressman Anthony Weiner. So the mayor is the most liked major candidate among Yellow Dog Democrats.
Tough year for Democrats. Education was listed as the top issue by most people, 32%, followed by housing, which 18% ranked number one. And I wonder how Mayor Bloomberg's education reforms stack up to these education-concerned voters.
Well, first, let me say again that I think, as I mentioned before, that the mayor, that people perceive the schools to be better now than they were 4 years ago. In addition, things seem to be shifting in terms of how the public views particular education issues. And of course, you know, the public is in favor of the more popular ones, such as smaller class sizes, etc. But they're not tuned into sort of the minutiae when it comes to, for instance, issues like social promotion, which the mayor has spent a lot of time to revamp. So it's unclear exactly what people are sort of reacting to when they think that the schools are improving, except that generally, aside from the economy, people think the city is headed in the right direction. And they seem to be sort of, you know, if not crediting the mayor for all of that, then at least being satisfied that the captain at the helm is steering the ship on a course that's in a productive strait.
And very specifically, probably the most relevant number here is 31%. Said the schools are better than 4 years ago. Just 19% said worse than 4 years ago. So it's not a revolution, but it is a net plus for the mayor, because the rest said the same or don't know. But I also see that you ask people in your demographic questions if they have kids in the public schools. And I wonder if you had a big enough sample to tease out how much those parents think the schools are improving compared to people without kids in the schools.
Leave it to Brian Lehrer to ask me a question that could be found so deep in the data that I'd have to sort of scurry through this huge banner book to my left to find it, with probably not enough time to come up with a satisfactory response before the show is over.
Well, we can follow up on it in subsequent days. But to me, that would be a pretty interesting thing to know, because that's who's really relevant.
Agreed. I feel delinquent in not having it highlighted in my analysis. I'll correct that before we post it. Let me say that there are other cultural watersheds that, you know, on the specific in the particular that we found. I mean, I just talked about schools in general, but some of the particular policy ideas that the mayor and that mayors across and governors across the country are facing, you know, we did test. And one of the things we tested was bilingual education, which we found to be unpopular in New York City. 62% opposed bilingual education in our public schools. But astoundingly, even among Latinos, 56% of Latinos oppose bilingual education, which means that maybe the whole struggle for identity, particularly Latino identity, doesn't generate the fervor it once did, or people understand that bilingual education may not have the utility they thought it did.
We do have a caller who wants to challenge you on one item. And it's Wally Pipp. Charles in Manhattan, you're on WNYC.
Good morning. According to a writer interviewed on WNYC earlier this year, who had just published, I don't remember if it was a biography of Gehrig or a history of baseball and the Yankees, the Wally Pipp Let the Kid Play Today, I Don't Feel Good story.
Yeah.
Is folklore, according to this writer's research, again, interviewed on your station, that Gehrig beat out an aging Pip fair and square that entire early year, starting in spring training and through the first months of the year.
All right. Well, maybe that's the case. I would not want to quibble with a actual Yankee historian who may know a little bit more than the folklore. Of course, sometimes the folklore gets it right more than somebody who wants to write a book.
Like the movie The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, right? When the legend's better than the truth, print the legend.
There you go. Thank you for your call, Charles. And the soon-to-be legendary Jonathan Trichter, director of the Pace University Poll, my guest on WNYC, our phone number to talk about things he may have found in the survey other than Wally Pipp is 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And let's take another call. Saul in Jamaica, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. Good morning.
Hey.
I just got two questions or 2 points. One is I would love to know the poll numbers of Mr. Mayor among Democrats who are very upset about his handling of the Republican convention demonstrators last summer, number one. Also, number two, from 1855 to 1915, it's like 60 years apart from Mr. Lord Cardigan. How could this guy be in both? Thank you.
Thank you. How could he what?
I didn't quite catch the second question, but I think the listener's first question had to do with the mayor's treatment of protesters during the Republican convention over the summer. The only answer is that Democrats don't seem to hold it against him. He seems to have shaken this off. I mean, this mayor has shaken off actually a lot of defeats, if you think about it, including a charter defeat, the West Side Stadium fiasco, and potentially now, you know, the loss of the Olympics to New York City, which may, by the way, have been a political burden, we found, incidentally, so that losing the Olympics, our Olympic bid, may have actually caused the mayor to fail up by taking away one of, or blunting one of the weapons that his Democratic candidates could have used against him, sort of like Clinton and health care. Clinton lost his battle to pass a universal health care bill but won re-election. Similarly, the mayor may have lost the West Side Stadium battle. He may have lost the Olympics, but in doing so, he may win re-election.
Of course, London got the Olympics that just announced this morning, if you haven't heard. And maybe one of the reasons we didn't get it and London did is reflected in your poll, because when you were testing what people are interested in, really, Gotham shrugged when you tested this issue, right?
Yeah, there's every indication from our survey that the Olympics were a burden here, and that the city citizenry was disinterested in the Olympics, the stadiums, and much of the effects that the Olympics would have caused in the city. The same is true of the stadiums. I mean, the local Democrats have little interest in these new stadium plans.
This was interesting to me because even the relatively uncontroversial stadiums like the new Yankee Stadium and New Shea Stadium, you found, I think, not just apathy but antipathy among these prime Democrats.
Yeah, the conventional wisdom is that the new compromise stadiums are consensus solutions that enjoy public support. In fact, there's a stigma associated with new stadiums. And, you know, since Democrats seem to be suffering from stadium fatigue, in fact, I would argue that a politician could win votes if he or she were to oppose any public subsidies for any new stadium. I think you read the numbers at the beginning of the show, but we asked prime Democrats to evaluate the Mets' proposal for a new stadium. They gave the plan one big Bronx cheer. Only 41% support it, while a majority, 52%, opposes it. I should correct you, though, a little bit, because in typical Mets fashion, they managed to lose another one to the Yankees, whose new stadium receives a narrow margin of support, very narrow, 46% to 44%. But I would couch that result as, you know, a non-committal sort of indifference. You know.
We'll continue in a minute with Jonathan Trichter and your calls. Also want to tease out an interesting finding on Ground Zero redevelopment that you have, among other things, on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Jonathan Trichter, director of the Pace University Poll. As we've been telling you, the high cost of housing and the difficulty in finding work break out as key issues in this new Pace University Poll conducted in cooperation with WNYC, CBS2, and the New York Observer. This was a random survey of 600 New Yorkers who consider themselves likely to vote in the Democratic mayoral primary this summer. So these are core Democrats, and the poll has a 5 percentage point margin of error. Let me do a little polling 101 with you for our listeners. Here's one that I bet a lot of people wonder about and have never heard addressed. Why is 600 people a meaningful sample in a city of 8 million?
The answer is randomness. And the best metaphor, the best way to think about this is as if you're a cook and you're making a big pot of soup. If you want to know how the soup tastes, then you mix it up in the cauldron and you can sample it at any point randomly and you'll effectively know what the rest of the pot tastes like. The other analogy is taking blood. A doctor doesn't need to look at your entire blood count to know what your white cell count is. He just takes a sample randomly. Similarly, we could take a random sample of any large population and broadcast the results onto the larger population with a statistical margin of error associated with it, but nevertheless fairly accurately. And as a result, survey research and polling is really the most powerful tool that we have in sociology and in examining the human condition to study group behavior.
I think one of the numbers that we commonly see in a national poll, and that's, 300 million Americans, is 1,000 people surveyed by poll, but by phone, for a national poll, and they come out with a 3% or so margin of error.
Yeah. The only difficulty, really, if you're doing a national poll, would come down if you wanted to break out the results, let's say, among states. So in presidential polling, if you're doing a national poll, you have no idea what people in Texas are thinking. Well, that's not true. You pretty much know what people in Texas are thinking, but you can't break down the results among states, but you can know at large what the population of Americans feel.
Do you find that it's harder as time goes by to conduct a valid poll because of voicemail and cell phones and hostility to pollsters leading people to refuse?
Well, the latter problem that you addressed, the hostility to interviewers, is not as big a problem as you suggest. There have been a number of studies that show that the marginally falling response rates actually aren't affecting the accuracy of polls. The more pressing problem, which is also newer and has yet to reach a crisis level, is the fact that a lot of citizens are switching to cell phones, and their unavailability is a coverage issue that pollsters worry about, but it has yet to sort of reach a level where statistically it has any meaning.
Tom in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. I have a question regarding something you said earlier about the education survey numbers being a net positive for Mayor Bloomberg. And I'm wondering about that since I guess either a majority or a plurality of people surveyed seem to feel that there had been no change, or at least they didn't know, or assuming that they felt there was no change, considering that the mayor has specifically asked to be judged on how he how the job he does in education, I'm wondering whether that couldn't be included among those who would view the mayor overall negatively in terms of education.
Yeah, I guess that's a smart question. So if 46%, was that the number Jonathan said, education has roughly stayed the same under Mayor Bloomberg, and he promised coming in that he was going to transform education for the better, then maybe stay the same is the same as he's failed.
Yeah, our poll found 31% think schools are better, 19% worse, 35% the same. And that big no change group may be a sign that there's skepticism among about test scores and improvement that the Bloomberg's policies have not addressed. It's impossible to know, but generally when you look at a poll question and you've got a larger percent that thinks better than worse and sort of the plurality thinking stayed the same, you've got a generally satisfied status quo, especially when you talk about an issue as controversial. A lightning rod issue like education, which is at the forefront of so many voters' thinking. I got to look at those numbers from the mayor and be pleased.
All right. But Tom raises an interesting question. And compared to what? Stayed the same compared to what? But Carlos in Middletown, you're on WNYC.
Brian, Jonathan, good morning. Hi. I want to make a comment about the issue of bilingual education in school. I am from Latin America. Two of my children go to public school in New Jersey. Both of them are taking Spanish, and let me tell you that it's the quality of the education is what is the problem there. And I would be against the bilingual education if the level is maintained like that. My little boy wrote trace in a homework, T-R-E-I-S, instead of trace, which is the number three, because he says that's how his teacher pronounces it, and that's how it should be done. So I think that bilingual education deals mostly the poor level that is there, and that's why most people are really against it. If it was at a level that you find in other European countries where bilingual education is high quality, then more people would support it.
Could be. That would be an interesting thing to test further. There was just this one question, I believe, in this kind of general poll, and it would be interesting to do a series of questions on bilingual education and see what, see if Carlos's theory is borne out, right?
Yeah, I agree. Carlos has asked a very particular question about bilingual education, one that's very important, and it gets at the why. What I've shown is just the what at this point, and as to the why it's unpopular, Carlos's theory may be correct. It may be that people have a perception of the quality of bilingual education in the New York City public schools and are disappointed with it, but I wouldn't know.
Carlos, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
And Jason in Hastings, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Brian, how are you? Listen, I don't know if I'm going to make too fine a point here, but I'm listening to your survey. My wife and I are actually leaving the city. We've been here about 14 years together, and we're leaving the city on just these very issues of housing and jobs and such like that. But I would not say to you that any of that is bad. Any of the things that are driving us out are bad for the city. I mean, obviously they're not working out for us personally, but I think that the fact that the city's got a housing boom and job market, and I was not personally for the Olympics or the stadium, but those things are all positive for New York City, whether or not I could find my place in all of that. So I just find it interesting when people would say that good housing prices are bad for the city. It doesn't seem to really make any sense.
Well, it takes someone with a big perspective to say that something that's bad for you is good for the population in general. But you mean housing, you couldn't find work and housing costs too much?
Well, I mean, it's not so much that. I mean, we've been able to, do it for a substantial amount of time, but we've just gotten married now, so we're sort of looking for something different. But when you jump off the pier from rent into trying to purchase something, I mean, it's just astronomical. And I'm an artist, and there's really a glut of other people out here who've got my sort of similar background, similar education, which is all well and good for me as a consumer of art. But in terms of my availability to have sort of access to things and feel sort of connected and get work that's going to really substantiate a $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 mortgage, it's just not there.
I think part of the debate then that we're dipping into here is one of competing goods. Obviously, it's good for the city to have an expanded tax base so it could build new schools and be wealthier and better off and provide better for its citizens. That would be one good. The second good would be the stability of neighborhoods and the allowance for families living in New York City to grow and to remain in the city, invest in it civically and financially, which would lead to safer, better, more interconnected communities, which is also a competing good. So, I'm not sure that, again, I should point out that surveys are not normative tools, right? We're not sort of telling you what the ought is. We're telling you what the is.
Yeah. So Jason, some people would say, as an artist, there are places in the city now where you can still go and find good housing and artist community, like SoBro, which used to be known as the South Bronx, or Morris Park, also a coming artist neighborhood in the Bronx. I may be getting the name slightly wrong, but Jason, where are you going?
Brian, I'm calling you from actually Southern Westchester. We came up here a couple of years ago just to get a nice rent. I'm looking across the street at a 10-acre park that's got deer in it. I've been looking for that for a long time. We're actually going to Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Wow.
Fully off the grid. But we're very much looking forward to it because, in terms of, competitive housing prices and, quality of life that we're looking for, and frankly, I actually just got off the phone with my brother-in-law. Our sort of standing or stature in a community as people who have experience in the arts and backgrounds in the arts and our ability to sort of access, and leverage things that can make a difference in a community is much greater in a smaller community where there's a shortage of people who have that kind of background as opposed to here was obviously a glut of people who have that kind of background.
Jason, trading places, if I'm not mistaken, with Derek Jeter, who grew up in Kalamazoo.
Yeah, I'm sort of hoping I'll get better access to him when he comes home to visit. Yeah,
to continue the Yankees sub-theme here. Jason, good luck. Thanks a lot for your call. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Jonathan Trichter, director of the Pace Poll, as we're going over some of the issue-oriented results in the first Pace Poll in cooperation with WNYC. There will be a few more during the rest of the course of this mayoral campaign. This one tested likely Democratic primary voters. Our phone number 212-433-WNYC. And David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering if there was any data in the poll that shows any lasting impact on the electorate of 9/11.
Well, we did sort of dip into how focused the Democratic primary electorate was on rebuilding Ground Zero, which was the site of the terrorist attacks on September 11th, of course. And we asked people to rate the issue on a scale of 1 to 5, where a 5 marked an issue that they were very interested in focusing on, and a 1 marked an issue that they were not interested in and not focusing on. The response was a mean 3.5. By comparison, improving the public schools received a mean of 4.7. And if you do some sort of standard deviation calculations, it doesn't take a quant jock to figure out that the citizenry is not, or I should say the constituency, or the electorate, I should say, excuse me, is not paying much attention to the rebuilding of Ground Zero.
Now, what was that phrase, a quant jock? Is that like a math geek?
A stat jock,
yeah.
Exactly. It's a polling term for the math geeks who show up at the APOR conventions and, twiddle their thumbs.
It might be another interesting area for further testing. But David, what did you have in mind, if anything in particular, by lasting effects of 9/11?
Well, I was thinking in broader terms on the attitude of the voters to the mayors and the candidates, particularly in terms of ethnic politics. I thought I had detected less importance, less identification with ethnic groups, and my theory is that part of that is from 9/11.
Well, in very broad terms, to answer, you know, the top of mind question in terms of the rub-off of the terrorist attacks and how it affects this race, let me just point out that we asked an open-ended question which gathered information on what important issue or problem facing New York City that the voters wanted their next mayor to work on. And terrorism didn't even show up on our list of open-ended sort of concerns. So, I mean, it's very sort of, for anybody who lived in New York City through that event, it's kind of almost counterintuitive to think that somehow terrorism is not playing a role in this election just 4 years later. But
and
the
yet,
answer is it's not.
And yet, when you ask the question, how important is it to you that the city protect you against terrorism, something like that, it ranked pretty high when you brought it up.
We have to probe it. We have to prompt it. Yeah, you can always raise the prospect of terrorist fears and receive some response. But I think naked walking into a polling booth without, you know, a prompt, I don't think people are going to pull a lever one way or the other based upon their concerns over who would protect them against terrorism.
And, you know, people forget, but this was a factor in the 2001 mayoral race, including the primary after 9/11, that shocked elites, if I can call them that, and yet was very widespread in poll after poll, which is that people even then did not put terrorism as a very high-ranking concern. Education still, you know, broke through as the overwhelming number one at that time. The mayoral race, of course, right just after 9/11. And the economy and other traditional concerns like that. And I always wondered if to some degree it just had to do with, you know, who worked in the World Trade Center and who thought they were personally at risk. Relative to these other real threats that day-to-day were affecting people, like the cost of housing and the availability of jobs, and terrorism, you know, still seen as a rare event.
That's a very good theory. I would only add to that another rival theory, and it's not the two are not mutually exclusive, but my theory, although I like Brian's theory a lot, my theory was that people have set schemas through which they view, judge, and experience elections. And these things are set and they're sort of programmed in a way that doesn't allow for to take into account for anomalous events, for singular events like the events of September 11th. And so at the point where people were trying to focus on the elections, they just threw out the terrorist event and tried to focus on the kinds of things they normally think about when they work their way through an election decision.
Let's go through a couple of things real quick in our last few minutes here. One, we didn't get to the top line local job market number yet, and it's strikingly negative, right? That I think it's just something like 8% said it's very easy to find a job in New York.
Yeah, and 67% thinks jobs are difficult to find. There are a lot of economic anxieties among the Democratic primary electorate. And the question then, of course, is how the mayor can remain so popular despite those anxieties.
And despite those numbers you just cited, your right track, wrong track results were pretty good. 46% said New York is on the right track. 35% said wrong track.
Yeah, it seems counterintuitive. These things seem to be conflicting. And the obvious question then is, you know, why? And I think the answer is can be found in another question, which is simply this, you know, which Democrats' economic plan are you familiar with? I don't know about you, Brian, but I'm not familiar with any of them. And for whatever reason, the mayor's Democratic rivals have yet to build a coalition around these economic grievances.
They're not making an impression. And far and away, when you ask what single living expense causes you and your family the most problems, people said housing. All the other items barely even registered. And you know what surprised me in that? No one said health care causes them the most economic problems. After housing at 51%, The next one was taxes at 6% of the people who said that was their biggest economic crunch. Then food at 5%. Healthcare did not break out with even 1% to become a category.
Yeah, so prime Dems are 8.5 times more likely to be worried about housing costs than taxes, and overwhelmingly worried about housing costs when it comes to, you know, their pocketbook issues compared to anything else, including healthcare, which is a national crisis. It says something remarkable about city living. It's a constant anxiety front and center in New Yorkers' thinking.
And you found a quarter of New Yorkers say they spend more than a quarter of their income on rent. Is that surprisingly high?
It's tough to say. I don't think there are polling questions that mirror this one in other locales, so it's tough to compare. But I mean, I know that sort of when I was looking for an apartment initially when I first sort of graduated college, I was told that I shouldn't spend upwards of 35% of my income on rent or I'd be in trouble. So you're talking about a significant amount of your income, you know, being sucked up by your rent, which leaves less over for living expenses and obviously entertainment and other disposable income. And it's obviously having an effect because people are consumed by worrying about their housing costs.
And what I really liked was your finding in response to that question that 14% said they did not know what percentage of their income they spend on housing. Maybe that's why this country is in the trouble it's in. Jonathan Trichter, director of the Pace Poll at Pace University, partnering with WNYC on this particular issues poll, and we're going to do a few more before the mayoral election. It's been really interesting. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And don't forget, tomorrow morning at 11, we will have the first Brian Lehrer Show Commentary Slam. This is like a poetry slam, except for your editorial opinions. You write a commentary of up to 90 seconds in length. Write it out. We will judge your pieces on original thinking, good writing, and the persuasiveness of your argument. And the best three in the hour will win our highly coveted Brian Lehrer Show t-shirts. Don't send these via email. Get ready to call them in tomorrow morning at 11. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.